And now on WRS, Michael McKay with the McKay Interview.
Hello, everyone. Now, unless you've been living in a bubble for the past few months, even years, it cannot have escaped your attention that there is turmoil. Some even use the word revolution in Iran. Turmoil is not new to that country. Listeners of a certain age will remember the revolution which toppled the Shah and brought the Ayatollahs and a repressive form of Islamic theocratic rule to power in 1979. I do, quite clearly. However, on a more careful scrutiny, those who do not follow events there closely will find that there had been turmoil in Iran in 2009 and 2017 to 18. But this time is different. It's different in the most significant fact that the turmoil, the demonstrations, the civil defiance, the revolution has been led by Iranian women, very brave and very courageous, mainly young women, triggered by the arrest by the so-called morality police of a 22-year-old Kurdish woman, Masha Amini, who was on a trip to Tehran, for not wearing her hijab properly. Now, if you're not sure what a hijab is, it's the head covering worn in public by some Muslim women. She was taken away for re-education and died in police custody. Her death unleashed years of pent-up frustration and anger met by the customary violence and brutality, including executions and even a crude and brutal public hanging from the authorities against the civilian population across the country. It's something which should not be ignored. It's something which I did not want to ignore, but wanted to examine in a particular and insightful way. I needed a little time to reflect on how best actually to do it. Now, the Iranian diaspora is of a significant size around the world and is quite numerous in the Geneva region. I'm pleased to have long-standing friends among them and sought out someone, a woman to be precise, who could explain what is going on in her country from her perspective and be free to speak openly from the safety of abroad, from the safety of Switzerland. Now, my guest today is asked to be referred to as Leila, concealing her own name because she has family in Iran. Anonymity is prudent, and I'm sure that you, dear listeners, will understand. And that wish of my guest today, I mean the act in itself, says a lot about the governance of that country. Thanks for making time for me, Leila, and thanks for inviting me to your home to record this interview.
Most welcome, Michael. It's a pleasure to meet
you. It's a pleasure to meet you as well. Now, to open our conversation, Leila, please tell me and our listeners a little about yourself and be as open about that as you feel comfortable. For example, I mean, how long have you lived in Switzerland?
Well, ever since 1984, I've lived in Switzerland, but in 1993, I went back to Iran, lived in Iran for 15 years, and then was lucky enough to get back to Switzerland.
So you went to school in Iran, you went to university there, or did you go to university abroad?
I went to school in Iran. I was lucky to go. By then, it was the rule of the Shah, of course, and I was lucky to go to an American school. Then I went to the university in Tehran. It was then that the revolution happened, 2 years later, and it was very tough times for everybody, I think.
So you finished before the revolution started or after? Were you at university during that
yeah, exactly,
amazing time?
Yeah, exactly. 1977, I entered the university. And in 1979, actually, the revolution happened. So for 2 years, it was just like normal life, you know, normal education as other countries in the world. But then everything radically changed.
My goodness me, yeah.
Unfortunately, there was a chaos in the beginning, very chaotic. But well, we were then asked to put hijab, the scarf on, and wear long mantos and to cover ourselves, which was something for us very far-fetched, but it all happened very fast.
So tell me, I mean, it's a big question to ask, but I'll just let you answer it in the way you want to. How is it, in your own opinion, your own experience, that Iran has actually arrived at where it is today in its long and very flourishing history?
Well, I really think the revolution, the way it happened, it was very sudden. It was something that for me in person and for my family, we hadn't even heard of Khomeini. We didn't even know that a person as such exists. But everything happened so fast. It was as if everything had been destined to happen. Everything was maybe planned to happen. But unfortunately, it happened. And we were all, I don't know when the Shah said the silent majority. I think, in a way, he was right, because the majority of the Iranians were silent majorities. And those who really protested and started a revolution were a minority. A minority either connected to different parties or factions. And, of course, religion has always had a very important role in Iran. And before the Islamic Republic, nobody really knew what Islam is. Maybe the good thing about this revolution was that we all got a better picture of what a religion can be, especially Islam.
People listening might find it hard to understand that, particularly as the majority, the vast majority of people listening to this program will have never been. So their only, if you like, contact or knowledge of Iran is what they see through the television news and documentary. But I want to ask you something a bit more specific. If you're looking back to the time of the revolution in 79, which overthrew the Shah, why did the educated Iranian people follow a man like Khomeini? I mean, it's been explained to me by an Iranian friend that most Iranians, and you've just in a way intimated that, had never even heard of him. So was the rule of the Shah so bad that he deserved to be toppled? Could you just give us some insights into what was going on in that country? It's a big country, what, 50, 60, 70, 80 million people. So it's a big place. What was going on there that that he deserved to be toppled? Or
not at all. I really don't think that the rule was that bad. You know, it wasn't bad at all, if realistically speaking, you know. Everybody, all Iranians were living a better life. They all had all the necessary the necessities, everything, you know. We all, education was free. Iranians lived better lives. They were paid better. There was more money, economically speaking. Iran was in a very good situation. I can still not understand why did all that happen. But I think in a way there were always parties within Iran, because with the rule of the Shah, there was only one party, and that was the Rastakhiz party in
Iran. So there's
an
organized political, when you say parties, you mean political parties.
Exactly, yeah. Political parties. But the leftists always existed. The religious people were always, they were always against the freedom and the liberty that was given by the Shah to the people, especially to the women in Iran. And they were frustrated in a way. And of course, the left, you know, there were different factions. Even I remember by then the Shah was saying always the Islamic Marxists. And everybody was making fun of this, you know, the expression, how can a Muslim be a Marxist, you know? But the Mujahideens, they were actually, in fact, the Islamic Marxists, you know? So all these factions and parties, political parties, they were working in Iran. They had their fans and maybe not members by then, because they were not out in the open. So in a way, everything was really working to topple the Shah.
Well, can I ask you a particular question there, Leila? That is that you said that during the time of the Shah, women were allowed to and given the... So even before the Shah, was it more repressive for women before the Shah? And did he, in a way, open up the society? I mean, in that respect, was he quite different from what had come before him? in the 20th century?
Of course.
Well, tell me, because I don't know.
Before the Shah, it was hijab. You know, women were covered.
It was like
of
that.
Of course.
I
and
see.
It was in 1962 that the Shah gave allowed women to vote. It was with the Shah that everything happened, really, to Iran.
Many people may not know that. So it's good that you say that. It's good that you explain that.
No, it was
that.
With him. The one thing that also hindered his rule was the land reforms that he did. In 1963, with the White Revolution, with the land reforms, there were a lot of Iranian landlords, aristocrats, who had plenty of land. So what he did was to buy the land from them and give it to the peasants or the farmers or those who worked for the landlords to sell it to them 30% less than the cost with 25-year loans.
And this was resented by the landowners.
And exactly. And a lot of the people that later became enemies of the Shah were actually the landlord families or the aristocrats, we can say the feuds, really.
Mm. It's a feudal system. Yeah, they wanted their land back.
Exactly. So everything, in a way, worked against him, you know. And unfortunately, it happened. Whereas if the revolution had not happened, I ask myself, what could have Iran been now?
We're going to come to that a bit later, Leila. But let me just ask you another question. I mentioned earlier that the majority of the people listening to us today have never been there, never been to Iran. And I've never been, and I'd love to go. I've been invited, but I've never actually had the chance to go. But I'd like to know, we're going to come now to the religious and the political aspect, because this is what's, in a way, seems to be on the television screens driving this current turmoil and revolution. What is it in the current governing regime's particular version of Islam that seems to be so anti-female? Because that's what it comes across to the foreigner. It seems to be anti-women.
Exactly. It is a religion that women have half the rights as men. Even when they are witnesses, two women's witness equals one man's witness. You know, we are, everything for women is, in a way, women is like, I don't know, when they say an apartheid, gender apartheid, it is really gender apartheid, religion, unfortunately. And maybe, I don't know, the first thing that they did was to ask the women to cover themselves. In a way, this was to disdain them, to treat them as a second citizen, you know.
But you said this was the case before the Shah anyway.
Before the Shah, women were covered.
Yeah.
Of course, before the Shah, women were at the Qajar, for example, the dynasty, and women couldn't even get education, you know. Only the aristocrats had a certain education within their where they lived. Really, it was a home education.
It was a very narrow society, a very narrow view of the world.
Exactly, yeah. It was very closed. Everything was really very limited and restricted. But it's with Reza Shah that women were liberated in the sense to come out of the houses without hijab. And for the first time, it was Reza Shah who asked women to unveil themselves, you know.
And through the regime, they take this attitude, if you like, these rules towards women from the Quran. They back this up with religious
exactly
quotation. Religious quotation. Yeah.
Everything that they do is, in a way, according to Quran, Quran rules, you know, that women have to be covered, their shoulders, their neck, their hair must be covered. But, you know, when you come to think of it, Quran is like 1,400 years ago. It's exactly like the Middle Ages, you know. And now I believe what is happening nowadays is that Islam is also on the 1,400 years since the evolution from this religion.
The Prophet. seventh century.
Exactly. So maybe we are just in the Middle Ages of Islam. Maybe, you know, we are moving towards a renaissance for Islam. And hopefully people in Iran now have a much better view of what Islam is, how they can be hindered by Islam. And now, especially the younger generation, they don't want this, you know, anymore.
The
Generation Z, as we call the TikTok generation, they know everything. You know, luckily, most of them have a good knowledge of foreign language, mostly English. They can listen to what goes on around the world. They can see what goes on around the world, and they are free. They just feel, why shouldn't I be able to live as a 16-year-old girl or a boy in England, in France, in wherever, you know?
I understand what you said. I'm going to quiz you a little bit more deeply about that in a moment. My guest today is an Iranian-Swiss woman living in the Suisse romande and wishing, for the purposes of this interview, not to use her real name, for the safety of her family back in Iran. We're talking about the current situation in that country. Now, Leila, please forgive this sweeping generalization, and it may sound like a rather odd question, but I think listeners may be interested. I'm certainly interested to hear what you say. How do mothers bring up their sons? I understand that you've got a couple of boys, or men, probably young men now. How do they bring up their sons in such a repressive environment? What values do they teach them? And what are their fathers? What values do they live by in the raising of their daughters? And I ask you the same question regarding how boys are brought up by their fathers. If you could just give us some insights into the dynamics of that.
Exactly. Just to let you know, I went back to Iran in 1993 and lived there until 2008. Unfortunately, what I personally witnessed was very, in a way, it's very sad, because I, as a mother, used to teach my sons to prevaricate and not to say the truth. For example, when they go to school, and if they ask them, do you have, because normally they used to do it all the time, you know, the teachers, depending on what kind of a teacher you're dealing with. Sometimes they were nice, sometimes very dogmatic, very religious. And they were asking, they still ask, of course, things go on still, but I use past tense because I'm no more living in Iran. They were asking kids, do your parents drink, or do you have satellite, or it was like
interrogation,
exactly. Yeah. And it's sad, you know, when you teach your kids at a very early age to prevaricate. That is really sad.
But
to live dual lives, you know. We lived inside, we lived a normal life. Outside, everybody had to pretend to be a, in quotes, Muslim.
So the girls had to wear hijab when they went outside. At what age did they start wearing hijab?
Seven.
At the age of seven?
Of course.
As young
the
as
age,
that?
Of course.
No, I didn't know it was that young.
Oh, yeah. At the age of seven, once they go to school, they have to wear a hijab.
I see.
And in the mornings, it was a lot. They had to say down with the USA and then go to classes. It's like a really, it's a brainwashing system, you know. But When you come to think about it now, after 44 years of doing this, look, the kids, that is the fourth, fifth generation, now they are protesting. Because they see this duality. They see, you know, people cannot pretend anymore. We, especially the young generation, they are not afraid. My generation and the generations after me, we were very conservative. We were the type that we were taught to be obedient, to say yes, to have respect for the elderly, not to contradict, even though we knew that maybe we are right, but we were always said, oh, no, no, you shouldn't do this, no, no.
But the difference is that it's the women, the young women that are leading this, the men are following. I mean, do you see that as being significant compared
very
with previous revolutions?
Very significant in a way that, you know, the women now, the girls that we see out in the streets, they know what life is outside of Iran. They know how people live. And they have the bravery and the courage to get out.
They are very brave.
Very brave. This is maybe one thing that distinguishes them from the other generations, the generations before, is that they are tired. They are sick and tired. You know, they see that they have no future in Iran as it is now. So in a way, this is the only way to a normal life for them.
So you've already sort of opened up a little bit into my next question, but just give us, the question I really wanted to ask you is, in what way is this revolution or this uprising different? But tell me a little bit more about what access people, young people, have to what is going on in the outside world. I mean, can people watch anything they want, or is there someone, if you like, is snooping to see that they're not watching Western television or Western this or Western that? What actually happens?
I can tell you that 20 years ago, most probably, they had far more power than now to
they being the government.
To constrain people from, they used to even ring. You had to open the door to come and see if you have a satellite or not, and to get the dishes, the satellite, and fine you and take the satellite and the dish and the box.
So they could come into your house and do
exactly.
That.
They were allowed to do anything, and they are still allowed to do anything. They still do it if they want to. But one thing that is different now is that the younger generation, they all are very fluent in, not all, but I can say at least 80% of the younger generation, they are fluent in English.
So it's taught as a second language, is
exactly.
It, in schools?
Exactly. Well, it is taught as a second language in schools, but it's them who are really going after it. Some of them, they are self-taught.
To make themselves competent
exactly.
And fluent in that language.
Just, exactly. Mm. And once, you know, they have the internet, they know the language, then they connect to the world.
Of course.
They see what passes in the world, what happens in the world, and they want to be the same, you know. They have the right and the bravery and the courage to go for it. So I really don't think there's a way back now.
I was going to ask you that because that's my next question, which was this current uprising. I use the word uprising and revolution almost interchangeably. Do you think it can prevail? I mean, what are the chances, in your opinion, of success? And just give me some idea of how you come to that assessment of success. Where do you think it's going?
I personally believe that there's no way back. This time, it must happen, you know.
But the stakes are very high for the regime.
The stakes is very high for the regime, that's true. But the problem is that it's not only civil rights of the people that is at stake. It's also, economically speaking, the country is really has no future when you come to think of it with the dollar rate of 70 rials at the time of the Shah and 420,000 rials now.
Could you just repeat those numbers because they really are staggering? Say it again.
70 rials, $1 was 70 rials when Shah left Iran.
And today?
And today is 420,000 rials.
420,000 to one.
Rials, exactly. Oh my God. The cost of life is so high. Inflation is staggering.
What sort of percentage is inflation, roughly?
You know, what they say it's 200 times, but it's not 200 times when you come to think of it. If when I was living in Iran, for example, a 500-gram yogurt was bought around 600 rials, okay? Now it's 600,000 rials,
for some yogurt.
500 grams of yogurt.
Amazing.
So it's 1,000 times more. Yeah. But what the government says, they say it's 200 times.
It's because because of sanctions this is all happening.
Exactly. Yeah. Not the sanctions, really. Yeah. It's just mismanagement of the whole thing, you know.
So it's competence as well.
Sanctions, the problem is that sanctions was just an excuse for the government to say, to manipulate everything and to use it for all their weaknesses and shortcomings. I think that the whole thing is mismanagement. And unfortunately, Iran, what I believe is a kakistocracy, you know, really. Because people who are not meant for the job are doing the job, you know. It's a kleptocracy.
There's a steal.
Unfortunately, they steal, you know. If they hadn't stolen, if they hadn't, in a way, sent all that money outside of Iran, if they hadn't used so much money for the Hezbollah in Lebanon, for Yemen, and for Palestine, and unfortunately, you know, when you come to think of it, 44 years Iran has been mismanaged, has been robbed of its resources, even resources in the sense of economics and also its people, you know. Unfortunately, those who really could be very helpful for the country, most of them have emigrated. They left Iran because they could see no future in Iran. There are a lot of people in Iran who are very capable and who can really make Iran successful in a way to make it a good country. Unfortunately, they are not given a chance. Most of them are in prisons. They are stopped.
Yeah. Leila, last question. So I just wanted to bring our interesting conversation to an end. Somebody once said that in revolutions, it's usually the best organized that win in the end, not necessarily the people with the best ideas. If you're right, and the present revolutions should succeed, what or who will fill the vacuum that's left by the toppled regime? And separately, what do you think would be the impact of a change on the wider Middle East region? It's a big question, but I'm just interested to know what you have to say.
Yes, quite a big one, but I believe, my personal conviction, at least, is that with the with Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi, Iran can attain the referendum that everybody is looking for with the help of him.
Because and where does he live?
He lives in the States.
He lives in America.
In Washington.
I see.
But he's traveling all the time, and he has been always a personality who has been consistent in what he says. For 43 years, he has said that he wants democracy for the people of Iran, that he's never wanting to be a monarch. He is not interested in being a king. He doesn't want any titles. He just wants to see the day that the people of Iran can choose their own government.
Leila, look, thanks so much for telling your very informative story and all the insights that you've shared with me about Iran. I'm sure our listeners join me in wishing you the very best of outcomes according to the wishes of the Iranian people, as you mentioned, in this new year of 2023. My guest today, speaking under the cover of anonymity, using the name Leila, which is a famous name in Iran for the Iranians listening in, living here in Switzerland and now a citizen of this country. Thanks again, Leila.
That was the McKay Interview with Michael McKay. And don't forget, you can hear that interview again on our website, worldradio.ch.